Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
All right, all right. Yes, that's right. It is What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. We are going to jump right into our interview today. I'm interviewing the one and only Chuck Abbott, who runs a fantastic site called the Ag Insider, which is part of the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. This is a daily compilation sort of newsletter that he puts together that I think is just amazing. I'm going to read his bio now. He is a contributing editor at FERN, Food and Environmental Reporting Network, and with three decades of Washington experience, Chuck Abbott is an old hand at covering U.S. food and agriculture policy at the national level, ranging from the nutrition facts labels on food and the never-ending tussle over food stamp rules to renovation of the farm program. Abbott, who grew up on a farm in northern Illinois, was a longtime Reuters commodities correspondent in Washington after a stint as the national farm editor for United Press International. And once again, the name of his publication is the Ag Insider, and if you want to sign up for it, and I highly recommend it, you can either write to Chuck at thefern.org, or you can just go to The Fern, they will have a tab for Ag Insider, and that will prompt you to pay your money, and you will get this every day in your mailbox, and it is really well worth its time. Chuck, thanks so much for joining me on this show. This is our maiden voyage together.
Well, it's been a long time since we've talked. That's very true.
You and I have never talked. You have been on Jenna Liut's show, which is called Eating Matters.
I suppose that I should pay more attention.
Yes, you should. I have long wanted to invite you onto the show, and somehow I guess our paths just I've tried a couple times, and I think you had some personal issues that prevented you from joining me, and one thing after another. But here you are, and here we are together.
All right. There's actually the flow of news got in the way of being able to talk about the news.
Jesus, no kidding, man. I mean, every day it's just an outrage. So today, for instance, I'm driving back from Rhode Island to do this show, and also after you, I'm interviewing Olivier Deschutes, which I'm very excited about as well. This is an incredible doubleheader for me, like the culmination of literally years of admiration from afar, and especially in the case of Deschutes, he's super hard to get because he doesn't live in the States. And I have tried many, many times, literally over the course of hosting this program, which is now going on over 8 years. So anyway, Chuck, first of all, I think you need to tell people a little bit more about Ag Insider so that they really understand what I'm talking about, because I'm not sure how great my description was.
All right. Thank you. I'll try to make this brief. Ag Insider is a daily, meaning Monday through Friday, electronic newsletter, electronic meeting. It's posted on the internet and it's available by email. If you read it on the internet, you can read the first paragraph for free, or you can subscribe and read the newsletter in full. It's, as our intro said, it covers food and agriculture and environment policy, mostly from a Washington, D.C. perspective, but if there's interesting news, we're not constrained by saying it has to be within the Beltway. The newsletter was launched in early 2014. 2014. It seems like a lot longer ago.
I'm sure it does from your point of view.
It began as a very first, very, very, you know, like one paragraph per story, and over the last 3 or 4 years, the folks at Food Independent Environment Reporting Network have put more resources into it, so that it's now a much larger publication. And we write our own. It's much more common for us to produce our own news rather than just letting folks know, geez, somebody else has a good story.
But you
today,
do
for
some.
Instance, we talked about Sam Clovis, most controversial USDA nominee in 15 years.
At least. We're going to talk about him a little bit more. But you also aggregate stories from other sources, don't you? In addition
That's
to the
own,
the reporting that you do as well. So it's really, it's a very well-rounded publication, in my opinion. I enjoy it thoroughly, and I do get it. So now that we've covered that, let's talk about Sam Clovis, the most controversial nominee for the USDA in 15 years. First of all, who is Sam Clovis? Describe who he is and also the position that he's nominated for which he has no apparent relevant skills.
Okay. Sam Clovis according to the CCB Journal, somebody who had almost rock star status among Tea Party activists in northwestern Iowa a few years ago. He ran for, he had a radio talk show on conservative issues. He ran as a conservative for the Republican nomination for Senate, did not succeed at that, and vaulted last summer into being a national co-chair of the Trump Pence presidential campaign. He was the chief policy advisor to Trump, and more importantly, he was very active. Importantly for our discussion, he was active in the Farmers and Ranchers Committee to support Trump. He was the intermediary for Trump with farm groups during and the farm audience during the campaign.
Yeah,
he would appear on radio interview shows to promote Trump's agricultural policy, which is basically, we love ethanol, we're going to back off on regulations, we love the free market, which resonated very well with rural America, because
yep.
it's that's an area that leans toward political conservatism, where there's a stretch of the world where self-reliance is a common virtue. And the president rolled up huge margins in rural areas.
Yes, he did.
To continue Sam Clovis' background. He's a veteran of the Air Force, spent 2 decades in the Air Force. He has degrees in economics, business administration, and a doctoral degree in public administration.
Yeah.
He was a economics professor at Morningside College in Sioux City, Iowa. Since the campaign ended, he has been the leader of the what's called the Trump Beachhead team at USDA. Those are the political operatives that were sent over to the department to run it while the political appointees get confirmed to the official jobs,
mm-hmm.
like Agriculture Secretary or Deputy Secretary or Undersecretary.
Right.
Those are the policy, policymaker jobs. Getting an idea how important Clovis has been, when USDA held its annual 2-day extravaganza of all things economic and agricultural, it's called the USDA Ag Outlook Forum, there was no Agriculture Secretary available. So Sam Clovis and Terry Branstad, governor of Iowa, now U.S. ambassador to China, filled in for the time slot normally reserved for the Agriculture Secretary.
Right. Incredible.
So Clovis, when the White House last week said the president intended to nominate him, Secretary Perdue said that Clovis is a trusted advisor and a steady hand, and that he's somebody who will look at issues with a critical eye, relying on sound science and data. You laugh because you know the punchline. The next sentence is going to be, he's nominated for a job, Undersecretary for Research, which, according to statute, is to go to someone who is supposed to come from a field of distinguished science with specialized or extensive experience in economics, education, and research.
It's important to mention the agricultural part of that, since he does not have that. He does not have any of those qualifications.
From my description of his background, a college professor with degrees in economics, business administration, and public administration. He does not, on the face of it, he does not have the resume that fits the job.
Yeah.
Three senators, Debbie Stabenow from Michigan, Pat Leahy from Vermont, Chris Coons from Delaware, have made statements questioning if Clovis has the quality, has the qualification. It's important to list Stabenow's name because she is the lead Democrat on the Senate Agriculture Committee.
That's right.
The committee that will review the nomination whenever it eventually gets to the Capitol Hill.
Right.
Excuse me, when it gets to Capitol Hill. Stabenow can be pretty steely in her operations. She's, for instance, during the negotiations of the 2014 farm law, she was insistent that the farm bill, was not going to reduce participation in food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, the farm bill included a reduction in food stamp spending, but it did not explicitly reduce enrollment. So Debbie Stabenow is concerned about somebody. It can be an obstacle. And we also have to mention that Pat Leahy also is on the Agriculture Committee.
It's
on the other side of it, the folks at Politico today say that a dozen or so of the agricultural groups are going to have a joint letter out today that will support the confirmation of Sam Clovis, and it'll argue that he's a wonderful advocate for agriculture and for, the field that he's going to be representing. So, it doesn't matter whether he strictly fits the bill or not. He'll be a good leader. And that gets the question of, then how much do people want to make a big deal out of it? It's, and that's the question to watch into the future, whether the Democratic senators on the committee and the Democratic caucus in general decides this is a fight worth having,
right?
Or whether, as in the case with some of the cabinet nominees, like Scott Pruitt at EPA, whether it'll be a matter of Democrats raise the complaints, but the majority party Republicans say, America voted for change,
right?
And and our candidates will carry out that the sort of change that America and President Trump want to see.
Hmm. Well, we'll see. We're going to talk about trade. We're going to talk about treaties and NAFTA in a few minutes, and we'll just see how much those farmers are going to love those trade treaties that are going to be. I don't know enough about how the trade. Protocols of how the treaties impact American farmers. But I have the feeling that Clovis and Sonny Perdue et al. Are going to be focusing on is not going to be necessarily for the well-being of the rank and file of the farming community. It's going to be for the well-being of the mega agribusinesses like Tyson, Smithfield, Cargill, you know, that of that ilk. But we'll talk about that for a minute, because I want to, just while we're talking about policymakers, I want to talk for a second about Sonny Perdue, because he, you know, he notably, you know, had some pushback on the idea of slashing food stamps or, you know, cutting funds for rural development. And so I wondered if you thought he would be the one and only standout in the Trump administration who is actually furthering the cause of his agency rather than trying to take it apart a la Pruitt, a la Price. Do you think he's going to be a force for good in farming, or do you think he will just, you know, play to the corporate interests to a degree that we probably haven't seen in quite a while?
Well, you know, one of the, when you ask about Sonny Perdue, I'm reminded that the outgoing Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack at the end of 2016 would, you know, practically tell anybody who would listen that he thought the ideal person to nominate for Agriculture Secretary would be a governor.
Now, would be, sorry, who?
I'd say Vilsack was biased because he's the former governor. But, you know, his arguments were that governors are used to having, you know, large and diverse portfolios and having to be able to move from one issue to another. And this leads up to, you know, the president nominated Sonny Perdue, a former two-term governor of Georgia, a guy who started out as a Democrat, converted to a Republican, became the first Republican elected governor of Georgia since Reconstruction. And if you watch Sonny Perdue or read some of his comments, he's a man who does have good political skills.
Yeah.
And so you get to the question of, well, what's happening with food stamps and all that stuff? You know, you got to remember, Sonny Perdue was not, Sonny Perdue was nominated because he supported the Trump agenda.
Yeah.
His comments to date, which, you know, like when he went to the House Appropriations Subcommittee to talk about the proposed budget, and people asked about big cuts that were proposed by the president, Perdue said, essentially, you know, most of that was written before I took office in mid-May. And, you know, the budget that was written says we're going to keep operating at a pretty regular level.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused some dissonance among reporters, you know, because, you know, we've all written stories saying big cuts proposed by the administration. Here was an administration official seeming to, you know, be sort of reluctant and all that. But, you know, yeah, remember, the budget they were talking about is for the coming fiscal year. The big cuts that the Trump administration wants are proposed in the following, would take effect in the following fiscal year.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And then you also get to the, the House Budgets Committee, which, you know, last week produced a budget resolution, which is about 3 months behind, actually 3 months behind schedule. I think the Congress has a goal of agreeing on a budget resolution by April 15th, income tax day, every year.
Right.
You know, the last few years, you know, that's not happened. But anyway, last week, House Budget Committee, controlled by Republicans, came up with a budget resolution. On the face of it, it calls for $10 billion in cuts from Agriculture Department programs.
Yikes.
But the language, $10 billion, I'm going to say, like $10 billion is not that much money.
$10
million. Isn't that crazy? This brings back to mind, Everett Dirks from the Senate from Illinois, who said a billion here, a billion there.
Yeah.
Pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Right.
But anyway, I can say it's not a lot of money because the Agriculture Department spends about $150 billion a year.
Yeah.
And as far as the programs that the Trump administration is talking about, which are the mandatory spending programs, which people call entitlements, which are things like food stamps, school lunch,
WIC
crop
benefits,
subsidy, WIC. Those programs are around you know, 90 billion to 100 billion a year. And you can say, and public nutrition, which is all the food programs, most all the food programs, well, you know, child nutrition is that's a little, you know, it's treated a little bit oddly in the way appropriations are handled. Anyway, public nutrition is about two-thirds to three-fourths of the USDA mandatory spending.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're getting into maybe $70, $75 billion a year for food stamps. Then you say, we're going to cut $10 billion over 10 years.
Meh.
So, I mean, it's some amount of money, but it's not, you know, it's not slashing your wrist open and letting it bleed. However,
yeah.
The folks at the Food Research and Action Center have noted, because they've watched the whole darn markup and read the reports, which, you know, explains a lot more than what you see in the dry list of numbers that the committee puts out in the bill.
Uh-huh.
They say, okay, $10 billion in farm bill programs, which I said, like, that's, you know, crop subsidies, conservation, crop insurance, food stamps, yada, yada, yada. Okay, $10 billion this year. Then they say $150 billion in food stamp cuts over the long term.
Oof.
by converting to a block grant type of operation.
Oh, I see.
And then a $1.6 billion cut in the community eligibility provision for school lunch and school breakfast.
Huh.
So, you know, when you look at where things are going, I mean, where they're going is that the Republican majority in the House, as it has in the past few years, wants big cuts in public nutrition programs.
Yes.
Notwithstanding Sonny Perdue, Sonny Perdue, standing with, you know, the budget that's been presented for this year.
Right, right. So, yeah, so he's not so great, in other words.
Well,
I mean, so
when push comes to shove, he would support what the administration has proposed.
Right.
I mean, he's part of the administration.
That's right. And what the administration is proposing is, okay, we're not going to do it this year, but the next year, conveniently after the 2018 elections, then we're going to start rolling out these tremendous cuts to program, and I don't want to call them entitlement programs, but programs that people depend upon.
Right. Yeah, they're called entitlements because they operate on the framework that if someone meets a particular set of checkpoints, they qualify. They're entitled to the payment.
Right. Right.
I
mean, why, as Michelle Obama said famously, like, why would you want to feed children bad food? I mean, I know she, you know, it's just like, it just beggars the imagination. I don't understand the motivation behind this idea that serving up wholesome and nutritious food in school is somehow a bridge too far in terms of, you know, giveaways to the Mitt Romney takers. You know, I really don't understand depriving children of adequate food, but that we will leave it there and move on, because, again, sort of related to the farm bill a little bit, which I know we can't really talk about that much because, of course, we don't really know what's in it aside from these proposed cuts. But farm incomes, I was told by somebody at the American Farmland Trust, who I spoke to quite extensively about a month or so ago, and he was saying that, and I've read this elsewhere, possibly in your newsletter, that farm incomes are projected to be about 50% this year of what they were, you know, probably 5 years ago when corn prices were spiking up really high. And I just wondered, you know, does that 50% income drop in farming, is that across the board? Is that livestock farming? Is it row crops? Is it everything? Or is it just the people who are involved in commodity farming like soy, corn, rice, you know, cotton, sugar beets? I guess those are the big commodities, right?
Yeah,
wheat?
Right. Okay. Yeah, you've packed a lot into that question.
I did. I always do, unfortunately.
It also really, you know, points to the problem of a, you know, flying at 30,000 feet, like we are talking about farm income.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it you know, yes, the figure covers, you know, or tries to cover all types of agricultural production. Mm-hmm. You know, fruit and vegetable farms. People growing, USDA likes to call it tree nuts. The big row crops like corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, yada yada yada. Livestock operators. It covers all that. When we talk about when USDA produces its farm income forecast, which it does three times a year, the next forecast to do on August 30th.
Uh-huh.
It agglomerates all those sectors in the economy to come up with one big number.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. During the lengthy commentary, USDA picks out the various aspects of the sector and talks about them, in March, which was the previous estimate. They, for instance, mention how are melon farmers doing. So they really do try to pay attention to the various components. Now again, we get back to this big picture number, farm income. By one measurement, you're going to hate this because I will become the two-handed economist on the one hand, on the other. By one measure, which is called net farm income, which sounds pretty, that sounds like what you'd want to know.
Yeah, it is.
Farm income is down 50% from its peak in 2013.
Okay.
And that's USDA's estimate for farm income, net farm income for this year. Because here we are, as I said, I'm the two-handed economist.
Yeah.
USDA also has a figure called net cash farm income.
Oh, net cash farm income.
Farm income.
Okay.
Right. That's down 31% from the peak in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So you think that, and here we go. Net cash income is a measure, USDA says, in the way USDA says, it's a measure of liquidity, meaning can you pay your bills?
Uh-huh.
I've seen one description which makes it a little more understandable, saying it's just like standard cash accounting. With your checkbook, somebody pays you some money, you put it in one column, you pay some bills, you put it in another column, you keep adding and subtracting, how much money do you have in the bank.
Right.
That's sort of what net cash farm income is. Net farm income, the more exciting number here that we've been talking about, down 50%, is a measure of wealth.
Huh.
And it includes things like, you have 50,000 bushels of corn in in storage in the local grain elevator in town. And then you just pick a number. Say like on January 1st, what was the average, the projected price of corn? And you multiply the 50,000 bushels, and that's what your corn is worth.
Right.
3 months later, the market goes up, the market goes down. You do the same calculation, and you get a different number.
Right.
Well, that's one of the reasons why net farm income can bounce around or take huge declines, because why are either of these measurements of income down? And I kept saying 2013. That's because 2013 was when a long running boom in the ag economy collapsed.
Uh huh.
You go back to about around 2006, and agricultural season average prices for corn, wheat, soybeans in the United States tripled over the next few years.
Right, it went up to like corn was almost $10 a bushel, I remember.
Right, yeah,
for about a year.
Because one thing that happened was 2012, there was a horrendous drought,
right,
which really reduced the U.S. corn crop, which made every bushel that was harvested that much more valuable because there were so many fewer bushels available.
Yeah.
And the result is because it was harvested in 2012, that carries into 2013 because you harvest in the fall and you start selling during the winter and into the spring. So 2013, essentially what happened in 2013 was the rest of the world started catching up.
Uh-huh.
And because there had been 7 years of high prices, everybody around the world was growing, you know, grain.
Oh.
In the intervening years, there's been, you know, huge, you know, grain and soybean production around the world.
That's right.
Last year, like, this is a crazy measurement. You know, cereal grains, which there's food grains and feed grains, you know, corn, wheat, soybean.
Right.
Barley, oats, sorghum. Try to throw them all together into one big number. It's like a record high. And this year, it's going to be almost record high.
Really? And that's in spite of drought and in spite of, say, like the big wildfires out in the center of the country?
Yeah. I mean, when I say record high, I'm talking globally.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. So, yeah, you had good weather around the world for 2 or 3 years. Well, actually, good weather. I mean, there was the El Nino, which caused problems in Southeast Asia and in Africa. But, you know, this is one of the, again, like, when you're at the 30,000-foot level, overall, things were good.
Right.
There were pockets where things were not good. Like I said, the El Nino, there were problems with rice production in Southeast Asia. Mm. Africa got hammered on grain production. That's a peripheral reason why they're, you know, they're short on food in some countries.
No.
And this year, you know, the United States has drought in the Northern Plains. Of course, 5 years before that, we had drought in California.
Yeah.
Australia right now is going through a, you know, 2 or 3 months dry spell, and it's the, you know, it's early in the wheat growing season, so there's forecast that Australia is going to have a markedly smaller wheat crop this year than it had last year.
Mm-hmm. So that will make the price go up because of scarcity,
crop.
Right?
And like one of the speakers, I'm sorry, what?
That will make the price go up, though, because of the scarcity, correct?
But, you know, the thing is, like, right now, world wheat supplies are huge. And there's, you know, in the longer run, if wheat production is constrained, yes, prices will go up. Australia is like the fifth largest wheat exporter.
Uh-huh.
I actually had to look up these numbers recently.
Thank you, Chuck.
One of the big surprises is that Russia, this year, this marketing year, will be the world's largest wheat exporter.
Uh-huh.
Ordinarily, Russia is like down toward, you know, down the pack.
Is that right?
And, you know, it's usually, you know, the European Union, Canada, the United States, Australia, Argentina, I think, is the other one. Yeah, I looked them up recently, but not recently enough to stick in my brain.
Argentina grows a lot of wheat.
One of the things right now is that, you know, there's huge inventory, huge grain inventories worldwide.
Ah.
So even with some, you know, some adverse weather this year, overall, the world is will remain in good shape.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we go back to things collapsed in 2013 when the big crops started coming in around the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's 4 years later, and commodity prices, meaning, you know, corn, wheat, soybeans, you know, other they're called row crops.
Yeah.
That are sold in mass quantities
and speculated upon.
They're at comparatively low levels, and they're expected to stay there for the rest of the decade, and maybe you know, beyond that, because there just aren't enough changes in the global picture to perk things up very much. Although, if we go back to, you know, drought in the Northern Plains, Australia getting, you know, looking like it's hitting for a small crop. I haven't even looked at Canada lately, but, you know, Canada is like right above North Dakota, and if it's dry in North Dakota, it's probably dry in parts of the prairies in Canada. So maybe Canada won't have as good a wheat crop this year. So things could start trending towards, you know, price improvement.
Uh-huh. And that would have an impact on the farmers who are growing.
And that would eventually you know, come back to the farm level, because if production falls, it doesn't have to fall a lot. That's one of the fascinating things about commodities, that a change of you know, 2 or 3% sometimes can cause tremendous changes in prices. If that 2 or 3% is the moment where you go from having an adequate supply to having a, for instance, a, you know, surplus, or the other direction, going from an adequate supply to being, you know, short.
Right.
So.
Well, it's, I mean, to me, it's, because I don't have a financial background and I find it very hard to track. The thing that always strikes me as something that's kind, there's something a little wrong with the kind of speculation, financial speculation in the commodities markets that have such an impact on pricing, as you've just described, you know, that something can change 2 or 3% and it can have this tremendous knock-on effect for the people who are actually growing the crops. And then as well, the ancillary businesses that support that, the tractors, the people who build the tractors and the, you know, the land prices. I mean, it gets very complex very quickly. And it's just for somebody who doesn't have that, deep understanding and knowledge as you do of those impacts, it's really difficult to figure out what is going to happen. And it just speaks again to the amazing amount of skill and extra knowledge you need to have to be a successful farmer nowadays, you know, especially if you're going to get into farming some of those commodity crops. But I wanted to move on a little bit, because I wanted to talk just a bit about trade treaties, and specifically about NAFTA, because, we have these trading partners in NAFTA. We have Canada, Mexico, and I guess a few... No, I guess it's just Canada and Mexico, right? It's just North America.
Canada, Mexico, United
and then States. And then we talk about, you know, tweaking that agreement or throwing that agreement out. And then when they started talking about that, then farmers got very nervous. But, you know, what specifically is it that Trump is not liking about NAFTA? Because he seems to blame it for, you know, the exportation of, you know, lots of jobs. And yet it seems to me that we export a whole lot of food to both of those countries. So I'm having a hard time understanding where it has fallen down on the job. Is it just the manufacturing part of it? Or because it seems to me that it would be really quite devastating to the agricultural world if we were to, for instance, get rid of some of those terms.
You've packed a lot into that question.
I know, Chuck. I'm really sorry.
Which is good.
There's
lots of stuff to talk about. When the president talks about NAFTA, his loudest complaints have been about manufacturing jobs and manufactured goods. The example that got all the attention immediately after the election intervention with the help of the state governor, who could provide some incentives, and that state governor was Mike Pence.
Yes. surprise.
Intervention to save jobs at the Carrier plant in Indiana. I can't say that phrase very well. Jobs and trade deficits are the ways that the administration tends to talk about NAFTA. And the complaint is that the United States has trade deficits with Canada and especially with Mexico. On the agricultural side, it's much more balanced.
Right.
And now I'm going to get into some numbers and just give me a moment. Okay. Canada and Mexico are 30% of U.S. agricultural trade.
Wow. That's big, right? Isn't that very big?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
That's big. 30%, and when I say agricultural trade, that's exports and imports. But the number is about the same, whether you're talking exports or imports. The way things rank in the world is that China's the largest customer for U.S. ag exports. Canada's number two, Mexico's number three. But the gap between China and Canada is pretty small.
Oh, is that right?
Like the latest USDA, USDA puts out forecasts every quarterly on U.S. agricultural trade. And its latest forecast has China buying $22.3 billion in farm exports this year, and Canada buying $21 billion. So,
wow.
In percentage terms, China is 16% of exports. Canada is 15%.
Wow.
Mexico would be 14%.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you know, when you get to the top of the, you know, there's like a pack of three.
Yeah.
And then things trail off after that. And on the import side, Mexico is the largest supplier of food and egg imports to the United States. Canada is second.
Wow.
And again, it's, you know, like they're, you know, right at 30% of imports. Now, I actually did these numbers. The export total, oh my goodness, come on, Chuck.
You sound like
the export total is slightly smaller than the import total. That's what I have to put that way.
Okay.
You could say maybe even then the administration has reasons to be mad. But for U.S. farm groups, you know, they love NAFTA because it's basic, you know, one sentence description is duty free access.
Right.
To, you know, which is important because, you know, no tariffs, most, you know.
That's a huge deal.
Mexico. Yeah. So Mexico is like, you know, big buyer of U.S. corn, soybeans, pork, dairy products.
Yep.
It was for a number of years, it was the largest single destination for U.S. corn.
Right.
Earlier this year, when Trump talked about border tax, and you know, the U.S. and Mexico broke off a visit that the president of Mexico was going to make to Washington.
Yeah.
The peso plunged in value. During that stretch of time, U.S. corn exports to Mexico decreased, and for the moment, Japan's the largest market for U.S. corn. But that, you know, like I said, that's in the first 5 months of this year. That was a calculation first done by one of the people I know, Alan Burga at Bloomberg.
Uh-huh.
And I went and checked, and yeah, that is how it stacks up at the moment. So anyway, we go back to, for U.S. farm groups, NAFTA is wonderful because there's been a tremendous increase in U.S. agricultural flow since NAFTA took effect in 1994.
Right.
I mean, it's like two or three times. It's been a huge increase. And you know, even before the election, farm groups were a little, like I said, Trump was popular in rural America because, you know, love ethanol, reduce regulations, going to get you tax reform, or people who are conservative, you know, politically conservative, that's an alluring set of campaign, you know, themes. But you know, during that time, I mean, the farm groups were worried about Trump's talk about pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which he did in the first day in office.
Yep.
And his, you know, repeated statements that he would, you know, tear up NAFTA if he, you know, and just drop out of it if he couldn't get a better deal. There's a anecdote that goes around that Sonny Perdue helped dissuade Trump from abandoning NAFTA by going to the White House with a map.
I heard
of
that.
The United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, they colored in the states that voted for, you know, that in electoral votes went for Trump.
Yeah.
And many of them were ag states. And the message was, you know, Mr. President, these people don't want you to drop out of NAFTA.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I heard that story, too.
Yeah.
And I also heard that the prime minister, that Trudeau had to call him agricultural secretary had to call him and explain, you know, and the same thing with the Mexicans. Like, it all had to be explained to him, you know, what this would actually mean in terms of food prices and, you know, and his constituency and so forth. I mean, you know, astonishing. But anyway, that's the way it was.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, I mean, farm groups, tobacco from USTR, United States Trade Representative, is the nominally in charge of trade policy, although Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is kind of the lead guy right now. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
USTR held hearings to compile its list of what will the United States seek in the NAFTA negotiations. And Farm Bureau showed up, and most of them said, you know, just don't mess up anything.
Please.
and part of this, and I mean, Sonny Perdue has said this, the administration said it as well, and which is like, you know, we're not going in there to make anything worse. We're only looking for, you know, to gain benefits. So we're not going to, you know, we're not going to try to mess things up for you. But the problem, you know, the concern for farm groups is that, you know, you can be taken hostage.
Yeah.
You know, somebody knows, you know, somebody in another country wants to get something, you know, for their side. So they'll just say, okay, we're going to, you know, we feel like, you know, we're going to put quotas on imports of, you know, dairy products.
Right.
For instance. And, you know, suddenly, you know, you've gone from a sector where everything was fine and you're looking to make a, you know, pick up some ground, and now you're being pushed back from the, you know, from where you were.
Right, right.
That's what, but, you know, it's not all hunky-dory. And just like a while ago, we were talking about farm income and how some sectors do well, some sectors haven't, but overall farm income is at a particular level. But within the ag community, yeah, they, you know, overall they love NAFTA. Don't want to, you know, don't mess with that duty-free access. But, you know, the dairy folks have issues with the way Canada runs its supply management system for milk. The wheat farmers along the northern border say that when they try, if they try to sell wheat in Canada, Canada has regulations which end up pricing their wheat as if it was feed wheat, and feed wheat means it's going to be sold to livestock, and it's not very good quality because wheat basically is grown for human consumption.
Right.
So they say every time we try to sell wheat in Canada, we get gypped on a price. But they say Canada can send all the wheat it wants down our way, and, you know, those Canadian farmers, they get a fair price. So the wheat farmers want things changed.
Because they get price supports from their government. I want to, and
you mentioned the fruit and vegetable guys in Florida, and probably also in Texas, but Florida talked about it. They're worried about, you know, things like tomatoes grown in Mexico during the winter and coming north because, you know, that displaces what they're producing.
Sure.
So there are issues that people can talk about within agriculture that go beyond the, you know, do no harm.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm of course. But I think, you know, I think the draconian sort of sentiments that Trump throws out that scare the crap out of everybody are not making negotiations towards better deals or, you know, making some sort of quota import, however that works. It is not improving the overall picture for American agriculture in, you know, as far as I can tell. But we only have a few minutes left, Chuck. And as I predicted, we've barely gotten through one third of these questions.
Right.
But so I'm going to jump to the last one, which is the following. If you were king of the forest, Chuck Abbott, what would your prescription be for U.S. agricultural policy going forward? Would you be an Earl Butz or would you be a Joel Salatin? Or somewhere in between, which is where I would be.
I would probably end up somewhere in between, you know.
Yeah.
I was thinking we wouldn't get to that question, so I didn't spend as much time thinking about it as I should have. The United States, you know, is remarkably lucky for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that the country is in a, you know, is in a temperate climate, and it has, you know, wonderfully productive soil, soils, and, you know, it has so many natural advantages.
Yes.
And the other advantage which the United States possesses is that it is a continental country. You know, it's a big country. And you think back through history and the things, how it could have turned out differently, you know, like if, for instance, if Thomas Jefferson had not decided to buy Louisiana, the territory of Louisiana, from the French.
Yeah.
Or, you know, then of course, then you also get that. And if we didn't have those wars that got, or for instance, if Texas.
Yeah,
you know,
if we didn't have Texas, that's what I was thinking.
Had decided to remain a republic instead of joining the United States.
Yeah.
The country would look a lot different. But the fact is, because the big country, it has a lot of heft in the world, and it also You know, again, because it's a big country, have tremendous, you know, advantages as far as food production. If, because we were talking earlier, and you said, well, geez, wouldn't wheat prices go up because we're having problems in the northern plains where we grow all the spring wheat? And he's like, this is such a big country.
Right.
That things like that kind of balance out.
Yeah.
You know, they had a nice, you know, the wheat yields in other parts of the country were fairly decent. And the United States has a big, you know, has a big inventory. So, but when you get, what would I do differently? You know? Oh, gosh, this is a farm bill to be written.
I wish you were writing it, Chuck.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that would be.
Why don't they? Why don't they consult with you?
A few years ago, actually, I got to write a research paper on farm bill issues, and you can arguably have a good time having a debate over what should the agricultural policy of the United States be.
Yes.
Because at the moment, we have, you know, the United States has a variety of ideas or principles that some ways kind of get in, you know, compete with each other.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you know, the justification for farm bills is to assure an adequate supply of food at an affordable price. That's a very post-World War II kind of explanation.
It's but a very post-World War II sentiment. Because
right, yeah.
I don't think that sentiment really exists right now in the hearts and minds of our legislators.
Right.
I think there's a very different sentiment out there.
Right. So, you know, the farm program was invented in the 30s because prices were terrible, and it was this mishmash between supporting prices and supporting farm income.
Yeah.
And we continue to go forward with that. And then in the intervening decades, they tacked on, you know, how conservation, meaning soil, you know, preventing soil erosion, assuring water quality, wildlife habitat, that those were equally important. So you have programs that essentially take fragile land out of production, and we have programs that encourage production on marginal land. And you run into the problem, which comes up every year and gets discussed every farm bill, that so much of the USDA's, you know, farm program spending, you know, goes out the door in annual payments, either in crop subsidies or conservation payments, and there's perennially not enough money for research.
Yeah.
Which, if you have that blank sheet of paper and ask people what should you be doing, it's like putting money in the savings account. You should be putting money into research.
Yes.
To assure the continued flow of new. New crop varieties, new management practices that will improve yields and reduce the need for artificial, you know, synthetic fertilizers and pesticides.
I think you have hit the nail on the head there, my friend. And unfortunately, I've got to call it quits here. But that is exactly what I think, because right now agricultural research is dictated by large agrochemical agribusiness type companies, mm-hmm. and there is very little independent research going on.
And part of that has been because
that's huge. The
public funding of agricultural research has been on a steady decline for decades.
Exactly. Well, Chuck, we will pick this up again in September. I will be inviting you back.
Great.
Well, I'd love to make this kind of a semi-regular thing. Maybe we can collaborate on topics that you're interested in that I can then draw you out on.
But okay.
I will say goodbye for now, and thank you so much for joining me. And thanks to my sponsor. And and we'll be back next week with another great show. Thanks for listening, folks. See you then.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization, driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.